Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded January 28th, 2013, episode 146, Chatting with the Chat Room. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. My guest geek this week canceled out on me at the last moment, and we're going to reschedule him. Yoan Allen, Senior Vice President at Dolby Labs, who I'm sure has a lot of interesting things to say about his 40-plus years there. But he was having some technical difficulties, so he's going to have to find a new location. We're going to have to reschedule him. But I will have him back on, and it will be a great show, I'm sure. Meanwhile, I can always sit and answer questions from the chat room, which is exactly what I'm going to do today. So if you have questions, if you're in the chat room at irc.twit.tv or watching live here at live.twit.tv, be sure to post some questions and I will get to as many as I can. to make it easier for me to see your question, if you include my screen name in the chat room, which is Scott Wilkinson, my name, S-C-O-T-T-W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N, in with your question, it will show up in a different color on my screen, and my eye will be naturally drawn to it, so that will be easier for me to see. So I do recommend that you do that if you'd like to ask a question. And, of course, Weirdami says that people not watching live here have difficulty submitting questions. Yes, that's true. Unless you have a time machine, then that's going to be the way it is. Now, before we get started, I do want to make a couple of announcements, one of which is that, as many of you already know, I will be filling in for Leo Laporte on the Tech Guy radio show on this coming Saturday, February the 2nd. San Francisco 49ers won their playoff game and got into the Super Bowl, decided that he was going to go to the Super Bowl. So off he goes to New Orleans, and that means somebody's got to sit there and on that ball and talk to a million-plus people on the radio, and I am always only too happy to do that. Not being a sports fan, I'm not even going to be watching the Super Bowl, except possibly for the ads, which are always hilarious and entertaining, and possibly the halftime show. I don't even know who's on the halftime show, but I'm sure somebody in the chat room will tell me. and that's always fun. Unfortunately, it's not marching bands. See, I'm a marching band fan. I used to be in the marching band in high school, and I really liked it. So if there were those, I would certainly be watching. But the big extravaganzas, yeah, they're okay. Anyway, that is that. So I'm going to be filling in on Saturday, February 2nd. So be sure to tune in from 11 to 2 Pacific time for an entire 3 hours of home theater goodness. The other announcement I want to make is that I have recently found a new job. Those of you who have followed my career with any interest know that I got laid off from hometheater.com some time ago due to financial budgetary constraints. And I've been doing some freelance stuff here and there, and I'm still doing freelance stuff here and there. But I also now have a position as the editor of avsforum.com, which is primarily a forum site. So audio video science is what AVS stands for. And members are obviously home theater enthusiasts, and they post all kinds of threads about this and that, questions and comments and so on. And recently, AVS Forum got bought, and the new company that owns it is trying to expand the content on the site beyond the forum. The forum is still going to be very important and the primary thing that goes on there, but we're also going to be putting up articles and other sorts of things, one of the first things I've posted is a poll, one of several that I will be posting in the next month, to ask members to give us your opinion about which of the Oscar nominees should win. Oscars are coming up February 24th, I believe. That's Sunday. And in preparation for that, we have decided to post several polls to see which movies and which actors and actresses and so on you think, the members think, should win the Oscar. So I encourage you to go to avsforum.com. And on the homepage, there's a link to that particular poll and a bunch of other stuff. And please stick around and look around. There are threads on displays and AV receivers and speakers and all sorts of stuff that should be of great interest to all home theater geeks everywhere. And I'm very happy to be associated with AVS Forums now, avsforum.com. As the editor of the content on the site. So that's kind of big news. And I see a bunch of people in the chat room are offering me congratulations. I appreciate that very, very much. Da Vinci Wonder has been a longtime member. And Midnight Rider, thank you very much. So this is all good news. I'm really happy to be doing that. Okay, so now let me get to the chat room. and pardon me for clearing my throat. At CES, I got the horrible bug that everybody got. It was just awful. And believe me, it was by far worse than anything, any other year I've ever been there. So Midnight Rider asks, why couldn't I do Leo's Sunday show from my location at home? Since I have no other obligations that day. Well, I do actually have other obligations besides the Super Bowl. My wife and I, Joanna, my wife and I, are producing a very large, very important concert the following weekend, February 9th here in L.A. And I've got a lot to do for that. I've got dress rehearsals and all sorts of preparation to do. So I couldn't be up in Petaluma both days. So as a result, we decided that I would do Saturday, and Leo has already pre-recorded Sunday to have new content on Sunday's radio show, but it will be on basically tape delay. Tape delay, that's showing my age there, aren't I? Digital delay, and it's all recorded digitally. Anyway, so Weird Ami starts off, what is a television? Yeah, right. I think I won't answer that question. Because everybody knows what a television is. So let's see. What is the best computer monitor for watching DVDs? I don't really look at computer monitors, I must say. I would want one that's 1080p, certainly 1920 by 1080 or more. Typically these, I mean, computer monitors aren't normally 16 by 9 aspect ratio. So it would be 1920 by something more than 1080. But then a DVD would be in a, or a Blu-ray, preferably, would be in a 1920 by 1080 window on that computer monitor. so let's see here. Boy, I got tons of questions here. iPad 34018 says, if OLED TVs become big, will calibration not be needed anymore? No, that is absolutely not true. Calibration will still be needed, and probably more than ever. Because from what I've seen of OLED TVs, their colors are very saturated, and the color gamut, that is the range of colors that they can reproduce, is much wider than Blu-rays and DVDs and broadcast TV actually use. So this is a big question, actually, because at CES this year, Panasonic and Sony in particular were talking about how their TVs have a wider color gamut. And the question that I asked both of them was, well, but Blu-rays and DVDs and broadcast all use this narrower, smaller color gamut. It actually looks like a triangle when you graph it out. And that's what the TV should reproduce. So how can you justify a larger color gamut, which means that some of the colors that you see would not be accurately representative of what the content creator intended? Their response was that when you shoot a movie, you are going to capture a larger color gamut, a wider color gamut. And that gets reduced when it gets put on a Blu-ray or a DVD or a broadcast. And so what these TVs do, supposedly, is that they re-expand it back out to its original gamut. Well, that makes some sense, except you don't know exactly what the color red of that thing was that when you originally captured it. You're making an educated guess when you expand it back out. Now, Sony and Panasonic both have an advantage in this regard. Sony has its own movie studio, Sony Pictures. So they know what things look like when they're originally captured on the movie camera. Panasonic has a facility in Hollywood called Panasonic Hollywood Labs. And that facility has close ties with all the movie studios in the LA area. And so they have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge about how those colors are, what they're supposed to look like as they're originally captured. But my counter argument to that is, well, the director of the movie or the show, yes, they probably saw the original color gamut when they captured it. Reds were redder, not quite so orange, and so on. But they supervised the shrinking of the gamut to what it's supposed to be on a Blu-ray or a DVD or a broadcast. And so what you get on a Blu-ray is what they intended you to get on Blu-ray. So expanding it back out is a really quite questionable. And to get back to the original question here, the OLED TVs have much wider color gamut, and they're going to need to be calibrated, in my opinion, so that that gamut comes back in to the gamut that you see that is encoded onto Blu-rays and DVDs and broadcast. That gamut, by the way, has a technical name. It's called REC 709, REC 709. And so absolutely, OLEDs are going to have to be calibrated as much as any TV. In particular, while we still have this particular gamut that people are using on Blu-rays and broadcast and so on. Once that gamut gets expanded on Blu-ray, which who knows if or when that'll ever happen, if it does, the OLEDs have the headroom, if you will, to expand back out to a wider gamut that could be then used with that larger gamut. So the answer is yes. We definitely want to be able to calibrate OLEDs, no question. Trini9Y4KB asks, what's the latest in smart TV technology? Well, what we saw at CES, we saw the beginnings of it last year, and we saw much more of it this year, were things like voice recognition and facial recognition, so that you could talk to the TV and say, find me movies starring Brad Pitt or whatever. And before, last year, it was very limited, these voice commands. You had to say, TV, change channel, volume up. It had to be very precise. Now they have natural language processors, which we've seen in the iPhone with Siri. As much as you like or don't like Siri or how well it works or how well it doesn't work, it is a natural language processor. And now we have that in the smart TV functionality. I would say that's probably one of the most important new developments in smart TV. SoCal Ray Jr. might be able to help me out on that a little bit. So when I get down to a little bit, I might be able to see him. Beatmaster asked, did I get to watch the Lawrence of Arabia Blu-ray? Not yet. I got it at CES. It was part of a swag package that I was very happy to get with the Lawrence of Arabia Blu-ray. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard so many good things about it that I can't really wait to see it. Sunbun says, Beyonce and Destiny's Child. I guess you're saying that that's who's going to be on the Super Bowl halftime, which, okay, that's not so interesting to me. So I can be doing other stuff that Sunday, which I'm certainly going to be doing, like rehearsing for this concert. I Will Too asks, can you explain why I should not be concerned with the Hertz number on a new TV? Ooh, good question. Very good question. Okay, you're going to see a number that is some number of hertz that the manufacturers are going to tout on their TV advertising and on the packaging and everything else. You're going to see a number on LED TVs, LCD TVs with LED backlighting. And that number is going to be 60 hertz, 120 hertz, 240 hertz, maybe 480 hertz. What that refers to is the refresh rate of the TV, which is to say, how often is the screen updated with a new picture information? Now, the information coming in is at 60 hertz, 60 frames per second. Hertz can be translated to frames per second in this case. And so 60 frames per second are coming in. The TV can refresh its screen at that rate, 60 times per second, or double that rate or quadruple that rate, and sometimes octuple that rate. Now, when an LED TV does it that way, they can, and typically do out of the box, implement something called frame interpolation. And what happens with that is the TV gets a frame that comes in from the Blu-ray or broadcast or wherever, and it gets then the next frame, a 60th of a second later. And what it does is it takes a look at objects in motion in between those two frames. It says, oh, well, there's a car, then in one frame it's here, and the next frame it's here. And so they synthesize, they actually create a frame that isn't in the original signal coming in, and it puts the car halfway between where it is in those two real frames. So that's 120 hertz. 240 hertz puts three extra frames between the actual frames and puts the objects in motion in the appropriate spot where they are. Now, that does, the reason that they do that is for sharpening motion blur. Now, when you're watching a movie, you're always going to see motion blur. Now, we can talk about this with regard to the movie's frame rate of 24 and how much that is sharpened by The Hobbit at 48, high frame rate, which is another question. Let's stick with frame interpolation for the moment. So it's coming in at 60. It's getting new frames inserted in between the real frames by the TV's video processor in real time. It's quite remarkable, in fact, how powerful the processor needs to be in order to do that and how it can be done in relatively inexpensive TVs. The problem is, it does sharpen the image, the motion. You know, when you see something moving, it's sharper. It's less blurry when this frame interpolation is on. But it introduces a side effect, an artifact called the soap opera effect. And what that does is it makes movies in particular look like they were shot on video. It looks like they were shot just like soap operas are shot. And a lot of people, the majority, I think, of enthusiasts, certainly, object to that side effect more than they object to motion blur. So in that case, if you fall into that camp, then it's very easy to go into the menu and simply turn off frame interpolation. Each TV has its own name for frame interpolation. Samsung calls it Auto Motion Plus. LG, I think, calls it True Motion. You're going to have to go into the manual of your TV, find out what which menu item controls that particular function, and just turn it off. And then what's going to happen is, if you have a 120 hertz TV, it's going to take each frame and simply display it twice, which does nothing for motion blur. It just displays each frame twice. And if it's 240, it'll display each frame four times. Now, I will add another little wrinkle into this mix before I talk about what the hertz number means on plasma TVs, which is entirely different. When you have a TV that is labeled 120 hertz or 240 hertz or 480 hertz, sometimes that means exactly what I just described. That is, it's showing the frame an extra number of times. But sometimes what it means is that the backlight, that is the source of light that passes through the LCD panel, which gives you your picture, is flashed on and off at that particular rate. Now, if you do that, if you flash the LED, typically it's in, nowadays it's almost all LED, backlight, if you flash it off for a portion of the frame, that does tend to cut down the perceived motion blur. So some TV manufacturers, I think deceptively, call their TV 120 hertz when it's really only refreshing the screen at 60 hertz, but then backlight flashing the backlight. Which they claim gives you 120 hertz like performance. But they don't say that on the package or in their ads. They just say it's a 120 hertz TV or it's a 240 hertz TV. Some 240 hertz TVs refresh at 120 and then flash the backlight. So it's difficult to tell, very difficult to tell which one is a particular manufacturer is doing. So that's just adding to the confusion. Now, getting to plasmas. On plasmas, you're going to see typically the number that you're going to see is 600 hertz. And 600 hertz, this number, has nothing to do whatsoever with the 120 or the 240 or whatever on LCD TVs. It's a different thing altogether. Now, the deceptive part about this is that plasma manufacturers, of which there are only three now, Panasonic, Samsung, and LG, they say, oh, look, we're 600 hertz. We're better even than 480 hertz. Well, no, because it's a completely different thing. That refers to the fact that, and this is going to be difficult to explain. Let's see if I can do it. A plasma TV works differently than an LCD, other than the fact that it's phosphors glowing under ultraviolet light. But the basic premise is that each frame of video information that's coming in gets flashed on the screen 10 times, which is where you get 600 hertz. 60 by times 10 is 600. It's actually flashed on the screen 10 times with differing durations. These are called subfields. And because plasma can switch so quickly, it can do this, and that is simply how plasmas work to create a picture. And the picture can be very much sharper in terms of motion blur than an LCD can. See, LCD TVs with 120 hertz or 240 hertz frame interpolation are trying to fix a problem that plasmas don't have in the first place, which is one reason I prefer plasma over LCD, LCD, at least in a room where you can control the ambient light. Plasmas don't have as much brightness. They can't output as much light as an LED, LCD TV. They simply can't, especially in bright scenes like snow fields, right? You're in the Alps, you got a lot of snow, it's very bright. The total amount of light that they can produce is relatively constant. So if you've got a small area of brightness, it's really bright. But if you've got an entire screen of brightness, that same amount of light has to be spread out over the entire screen. So as a result, they're generally not as bright, which is one reason why they don't sell as well on the show floor, because they can't compete with LED LCDs. But anyway, I wanted to make the point that the hertz number associated with plasmas is a completely different thing than the hertz numbers associated with LED and LCD TVs. And if you think they're the same, think again. They're not. So that was a long explanation. Let's see. Hermes asked, does 8K really blow my mind? And when does it reach a $2,000 price point? Well, 8K is going to be a while. There's only two or three 8K cameras in the world, and they're owned by NHK, the Japanese broadcasting company. And they've shot some stuff in 8K, and I've seen some stuff, native stuff in 8K, and it looks great. And a lot of people are saying, oh, well, you know, 4K was the big thing at CES. Well, we'll just skip that and go to 8K. You got to remember, though, that the higher the resolution, the larger the screen needs to be in order to take advantage of that extra resolution, for the most part. I will say, and this is going to be controversial, that even at a smaller screen size, when I'm looking at native 4K content on a 4K display, I perceive a smoothness to the picture, a depth to the picture that isn't there with 2K or 1080p on a 1080p set. It's just something that I have noticed and I have observed, even though I know intellectually that my eye, no one's eye, can see the difference in detail because we can't resolve those pixels, especially at a smaller screen size, unless you're right up close to the screen. So I think that 4K has a number of advantages, and we're going to see that certainly well before 8K and long before 8K becomes $2,000. 4K is, in fact, close to $2,000 right now, or will be when it's released. Westinghouse, for example, had a 50-inch 4K Ultra HD display TV in their hotel suite, which they said was going to cost $2,500. Hisense, a Chinese company, which you might not have heard of before, but you will. They are a very big company and getting bigger all the time, growing while the Japanese stalwarts are shrinking, losing money. I heard from one guy there that they had a 50-inch for $2,000. So there's your 2K right there, $2,000, I mean, with a 4K display. Now, is a 50-inch 4K display going to really be good? Yes, it is, potentially, anyway. I mean, if they build it poorly and it's got bad black levels and poor color, then it's still going to be bad. But, you know, assuming that it's reasonably good, the big problem is content. You know, for the moment and for the near future, these TVs are going to have to upscale Blu-ray at 1080p. So the quality of the image is going to be based on the quality of the upscaler. So we shall see how good that is. I've seen some good examples of that, and I've seen some bad examples of that. And I've seen some examples where of side by side, a 4K image, a 4K TV upscaling Blu-ray, and a 1080p TV showing the same image. I saw that at the Sony booth at CES. And to tell you the truth, I didn't see a lot of difference. In certain moments, certain shots, there was a moderate difference. But in most cases that I was looking at, I didn't really see a big difference. So, you know, what's the point? Well, the point is to wait for 4K distribution. How's that going to happen? Well, a couple different ways. LG had in its booth the Korean broadcast company showing 4K broadcasting, terrestrial broadcasting. But there's no standard for that. It was only an experiment. Sony had a much better idea, which was to offer 4K native content downloadable. And sure, it might take overnight or even a couple of days, but once you download it into a big hard drive, there it is, and you can play it. I think that's probably the best short-term solution. Netflix was also showing 4K streaming, and I didn't actually get a chance to see that. That was in Samsung's booth. So Big Ginge asked the same question. Is it worth skipping 4K and hold out for 8K? I don't think so myself, because I think 8K, as I said earlier, is going to take a while to really come into its own. And the argument for getting a larger screen still is even more important with 8K than it is with 4K. Sunbun asks, why should I choose an Apple TV versus a Roku and vice versa? Well, that's a good question. I don't have a definitive answer on that. My understanding is that the Apple TV is more or less tied into the Apple infrastructure, right? So iTunes. I think it does offer you access to other things, like Netflix, perhaps. But the Roku is much more egalitarian. It has a much wider view of the online streaming world. Plus, the Apple TV, as far as I know, I don't own one, actually, so I can't say for sure, but I believe it's limited to 720p. That might have changed by now, and I'm sure someone in the chat room will correct me if I'm wrong on that. Let's see here. Curtis B. asks, doesn't one color of OLED fade much faster than the rest? Yes, that's been one of the problems with OLED, is that the blue color has tended to degrade much more quickly than red or green, which is why we think LG is using white OLED material and putting color filters in front of it, red, green, and blue color filters. So that may be a solution to the problem. Samsung has decided to use red, green, and blue OLED material, but their TV isn't out yet. And they haven't, even at CES, they didn't have a model number, pricing, or availability. LG has a model number, pricing, $12,000 for a 55-inch, and availability should be available in March in the U.S. It's already selling elsewhere around the world. So, let's see. Death by Band-Aid asks, what is the most flexible display to hook up a series of game consoles of varying video input? Well, I would guess, I think just about any TV would be fine. I'm not a gamer, so I'm gonna defer this to gamers in the chat room. To me, it seems that any TV that has an HDMI input should work fine. Now, in terms of games, people are concerned that plasma would have some image retention problems, and I would agree. With games that have like a static scoreboard in one corner or something like that, some static element of the image that doesn't move. And if you play games for days or weeks at a time and that image stays there, yes, you're going to get screen, what's called image retention, which at first is temporary. But if you leave it there for many, many weeks, it could become permanent. LCD TVs typically don't have that problem, which is why if you're going to do mostly games, LCD LED TVs are probably the better way to go. Most TVs also have several picture presets, picture mode presets, one of which is typically called game. Now, that's going to be a wider color gamut, a brighter image. It's just going to basically torch the thing out, which on a plasma is not typically a good idea. Another reason to use LED, LCD on if you're going to be doing mostly gaming. Euchre X200 says, doesn't the brain experience motion blur naturally? Yes, it does. And that's a very good point. The human visual system, when you see things going by quickly, they look blurry in the real world, which is one reason why people don't like frame interpolation and they don't like high frame rate movies such as The Hobbit, which just came out, because at 48 frames per second, twice the normal video or movie frame rate, you see things a lot sharper. Now, on the other hand, I went and saw The Hobbit at 48 frames per second, and there was still plenty of motion blur. 48 frames per second doesn't mean there won't be any motion blur. It'll just be less. And I didn't find it objectionable, but a lot of people do and did. So, that's kind of a preference thing that you have to think about. Which way did it turn out, Midnight Rider, which way did it turn out to be the best way to watch The Hobbit? You know, I didn't actually make it into C24 frame. I intended to. I wanted to compare them, but I didn't. I only saw it in 48. I liked it. I thought it was perfectly fine. I thought there were a couple of moments where it looked like a cheesy PBS special from the 60s, but it wasn't consistent. It didn't happen all the time. It was only on certain scenes. And I'm not sure why that is, but overall and in general, I thought it looked great. I was perfectly happy with it. Jim Four asks, what kind of center speaker is good for surround sound? The answer to that is whichever center speaker matches your front, right, and left. Here's the important point here about surround speaker systems. You want the tonal balance, the tonal signature of at least your front three speakers to match, to be the same. Ideally, you want that also to be true of the surrounds. Why? Because when sounds pan from one speaker to the next, from one side of the room to the other, from the front to the back, if you have speakers from different manufacturers or even different lines within a manufacturer that have different tonal signatures, then it's going to sound weird. When it's not going to sound integrated, it's not going to sound like a flow when you pan from one side to another or from front to back. You're going to hear that tonal difference. So I always recommend that you get at least the front three and preferably all of your main surround speakers from the same manufacturer, from the same model line, because the manufacturer has gone to some trouble, typically, hopefully, to match that tonal characteristic. All speakers have a tonal character. And so you want that to be the same, at least across the front. So that is the answer to that question. Terry K says, does the new ZT series Panasonic plasma have a significantly better picture than the 2012 VT series? Were you able to see them side by side at CES? Yes, I was. And the ZT60 is appreciably better than the 2012 VT50. For one thing, the black levels, certainly better. And they did a very good thing. They did what Pioneer used to do with the Kuro, which is they took the VT50 and the ZT60, put them on a wall together, same size display, 65-inch, fed them the same image from a Blu-ray through a splitter, and just said, okay, compare them. Now, the VT50 did and still looks great. It was, by many estimations, the best flat panel of 2012. But the ZT60 certainly beat it in terms of black level. No question about it. When you went to a black interstitial, which is that momentary blackout between scenes, you could see, and this was in a black room, by the way, totally light-controlled room, you could see the VT50, you could see the screen. It was a very dark gray, but it was visible. You could not see the ZT60 screen. It was completely black. And the same was true of actual imagery, too. They showed a lot of night scenes and stuff like that. And the ZT60 had definitely a better black level. So it is a noticeable improvement over the VT. F-Loop asks, any advice for finding displays with the best video processing? This is a great question. Most of the content coming in, over the air, cable, streaming, needs some processing help. Deblocking, denoising, scaling, all that stuff. Reviews don't seem to be much help. Well, that's true. Many reviews don't really evaluate that too much. I tried to when I was doing reviews for HomeTheater.com. And when I get back to doing reviews, I will certainly spend more time doing that because I think that is very important. I don't think I know. I can't think of any good way to research that other than if a manufacturer lists what processor they're using. And the good ones are from Marvell. They make a processor under the brand name Qdeo, Q-D-E-O. DVDO makes a very good processor. That's it used to be Anchor Bay. I think they're on their own now. These companies, they change hands all the time. But if you see one by DVDO, that's going to be a good one. Faroujia used to be sort of the cream of the crop. They sort of aren't anymore, but they always did a good job, in my opinion. So if you see one with Faroujia DCDI, I think that does a very good job, myself as well. Let's see here. Whatever happened to 7.1 surround? It's still there. You can buy Blu-rays with 7.1. Movies are made in 7.1 now. Whether or not it's worthwhile to put two extra speakers in your room, in your home theater, that's kind of your call. Again, it's a preference kind of a thing. I don't find it necessary myself. I have a 5.1 system, and I find that to be perfectly fine. I will, too. Now I have no idea how to buy a TV. I feel old. Well, join the club. Buying a TV is difficult. And what I recommend is listening to this show, of course. And going to various websites to read reviews. I think HomeTheater.com does a great job with TVs. Tom Norton is the TV reviewer there, and he's very, very knowledgeable. And he will give you the straight scoop. CNET, I typically think, does a very good job with TVs as well. The recent brouhaha over the fact that CBS owns CNET, and CNET tried to give the Dish Network Hopper a Best of CES award, and CBS forced them to pull it because the Hopper lets you skip commercials. That's a bit of a problem. But that notwithstanding, I still think their TV reviews are quite good. So I would look there as well. Let's see. Good Sound asks, will HD Base T ever be adopted as an interconnect standard for HD TVs? Tired of the short cable limits for HDMI. Yeah, that is a problem. I don't know, to tell you the truth. The same question was asked, I heard it many times at CES, about DisplayPort. Will that ever supplant HDMI? And my answer to both is probably not. And the reason is that HDMI is so entrenched in the marketplace. It's everywhere. It's on every product. Well, every home theater type product, you know, AV type product. And anytime you change a connector, it's a massive undertaking for the industry, for each manufacturer to retool and to, you know, switch gears. So I don't think it's likely. HD Base T has a lot going for it. It carries Ethernet, audio, video, even some power along one cable, more so than HDMI. It carries more information than HDMI does, even though HDMI now carries Ethernet. But it's got a lot going for it. But will it replace HDMI? I don't think so. Another solution to the short cable problem is to get a wireless HDMI system like the DVD-O Air, for example, which has a transmitter and a receiver. And the transmitter is connected to the source or the AV receiver. The receiver, wireless HDMI receiver, is connected to the display, and that eliminates the cable length problem, also the cable problem altogether. Okay, so got a bunch more questions. Before we do, though, before we continue, I do want to thank one of our sponsors. We have two sponsors for this episode, one of which is Netflix. Now, of course, we were talking about Netflix a little earlier. They're experimenting with streaming 4K. But in the meantime, you can stream current standard TV at 720 and 1080, thousands of TV episodes and movies directly into just about any consumer PC or TV or Blu-ray player, gaming console, Roku box, or any of these other dedicated boxes, even your smartphone or tablet. You know, just about every consumer electronics device has a Netflix app in it, which lets you stream all of that content for one low monthly fee as much as you want. And you can even start on one device and finish on another. So, you know, you start watching the movie in the home theater. You go, well, I'm getting a little sleepy. Maybe I better head on to bed, but I really want to finish this movie. So you just pause it, move into the bedroom, and start up right where you left off. You can even try it for 30 days for free. Those few of you who haven't tried it already, just go to netflix.com/twit and try it for 30 days for free. See if you like it. I think you will. I certainly do. I find a lot of content on there that I couldn't find anyplace else. And so it's a real convenient way to go. I do recommend it. Just go to netflix.com/twit. Okay, let's see. Got tons of other questions here. Super Bowl deals? Lou MM asks. Cave and buy a nice one for cheap. Wait for 4K this year. Deals? You know, I haven't looked at Super Bowl deals. Super Bowl is certainly one of the biggest TV buying times of the year. And I must admit, I haven't looked for Super Bowl deals particularly, but I wouldn't wait for 4K this year. Well, you know, again, if you want to get a smaller one from like Westinghouse or Hisense, I don't know when they'll even be available. And when they are, mostly they're going to be upscaling. Oh, and that reminds me, I wanted to say one more thing about upscaling in particular, video processing, which was asked earlier. If you go into a store to buy a TV, and a lot of you are going to buy online, but if you do go into a store, take a Blu-ray that you're very familiar with, that you know really well, and ask them to play it on the TV that you're interested in. If they won't do it, if they'll say, oh, no, we can only play the stuff that we're playing, walkout. Presumably, a better store, maybe perhaps a Magnolia inside of a Best Buy, would let you play your own content. And even better, if you have something like the Spears and Munsell HD Benchmark Blu-ray setup DVD, it also has some evaluative test patterns on it to show you how well the thing is upconverting, deinterlacing, and that sort of thing. So if you get a chance to try out a TV before you buy it, that's one way to determine if the processing is any good, is to take well-known material, play it, and see how well it does. let's see. Oscar Furtado asks, what media player do I use? I have a Boxy Box, and it works very well. The only thing I don't like about it is that it doesn't have Amazon Instant Video. And so I do intend to get a Roku, just to put them side by side. A foreign source, by the way, says Apple is better. That is all. And Richard Ya says that Apple TV's main advantage is AirPlay if you have an iPhone or iPad. And that is a good advantage. Jaybird asks, will we see 4K on a disc or streaming or Sony's hard drive the way to go? I think I answered that question earlier. I think the hard drive delivery by downloading is going to be the best way to go. Blu-ray might come out with a 4K disc, but it's going to take them a while to figure that out. this is, let's see here. Undermind says 4K and 8K broadcasts are both going to be under the ITU Rec 2020 and use NHK standards called UHD. So sort of standardized already. Yes, but which codec are they going to use? And what, is it going to be 8-bit or 10-bit color? And is it going to be 422 or 420? I suspect 420, which is a form of color compression. So there's still quite a bit of work yet to be done to fully standardize that. Midnight Rider. Will all the formats of The Hobbit be available on Blu-ray? No. Blu-ray cannot do 48 frames per second 3D. They are working on possibly including that in the next version. But again, that's going to take a while to finalize. This is a consortium of 70 or 80 companies now developing Blu-ray. More than that, actually, a couple hundred. There's 70 or 80 who are developing HDMI, which is another bottleneck, is that HDMI doesn't support 48 frame 3D. So we're not going to see The Hobbit at high frame rate on Blu-ray. You're not going to see it. So let's see here. Del Shiro asks, or Shiro, is it possible to add a sound bar to a 7.1 to make up left, right, and center? Yes, it is. In fact, some sound bars are designed to be the front, right, and center of a surround sound system. And they do not provide pseudo surround or simulated surround. They just provide the front, right, and left, front, right, left, and center. Now, Vizio announced at CES that they were going to be marketing a soundbar. They used to do this, and then it went away, and now it's coming back. Three front channels in the soundbar, two separate surround speakers, and a separate subwoofer, which is the best of both worlds. If you want a soundbar in order to be visually discreet, then putting the front, right, left, and center in a soundbar is a good idea. I don't like those simulated surrounds that much. Yamaha does a pretty good job of it. But in general, it's better to have real surrounds. So that is what I definitely recommend there. But yeah, you could certainly do that. Okay, now, before we go on, we only have a few more minutes left, but I do want to make sure to thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Bespoke Post. I don't know if you've heard of these guys or not, but it's pretty amazing. Bespoke Post is a product subscription service for men, which I suspect most of you watching are. Each month, Bespoke Post sends you an exclusive package with products ranging from gadgets to accessories and more. The website to go to is bespokepost.com/twit. You can even sign up now and receive 20% off your first month subscription of $45 at bespokepost.com/twit. Now, how it works is this. It's a subscription club, and each month they send you this box of stuff that has a theme. I just got the January box, which they call the Box of Awesome. And this one is very cool. It came in a wooden cigar box. And this month's theme is polishing, as in polishing your shoes. And it comes with some really, really nice, very high-end shoe polish and brushes and laces and a cloth and all that kind of stuff. Very cool. Very cool. They've had other things, coffee kits, cocktail sets. Each box is worth well over $45, which is the monthly subscription fee. It's quite remarkable, actually, what they're doing, and very high quality. Just nothing but the best, actually. So it's either a great gift for yourself or for the man in your life. 1 month gift is $50, 3 months is $135, and half a year is $270. So you save some money on the longer time subscriptions. And it's certainly great if you're having a hard time finding that special thing for the guy who has everything. These boxes of awesome are quite awesome, as it happens. If you're interested, just visit Bespoke Post at bespokepost.com/twit. Save 20% off your first box by going to bespokepost.com/twit. And we thank Bespoke Post very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. Okay, let's get back to a few more questions. Let's see here. Spider, nice screen name. Given the choice between Crestron, Control 4, and AMX, which do you prefer and why? Well, that's a good question. My understanding is that Control 4 is quite a bit less expensive than Crestron and AMX. Also, Crestron and AMX are notoriously difficult to program. So if you're building a new home and you've got the scratch to hire somebody to do it, then any of them would be fine. I must admit I don't have any direct experience with any of them. But I do know that Crestron and AMX require some serious programming chops. They offer training courses and stuff for professional installers. My understanding is that Control 4 is quite a bit less expensive in terms of the hardware. It may be easier to program as well. I don't actually know that. So anybody here can jump in to that. Lawndog is asking, so are you saying that HDMI is upscalable for the future? Yes, it is. In fact, they are working on the next specification. We're now at 1.4a, and they are working on the next one, which the HDMI licensing group and the HDMI forum, which is the larger body, are trying to do without numbering it, which I'm not sure I agree with. Yeah, they're trying to avoid confusion, and they're trying to make it a little clearer about what that means. And it's true that the numbers, it's difficult to know exactly what they mean, but they're trying, but whatever the next version is called, and it should be released sometime this year, first half of the year, I believe they said, when I talked to them at CES, it will have double the bandwidth. So right away, it'll be able to do 4K at 60 frames per second. Right now, HDMI is limited to 4K, or more specifically UHD, Ultra HD, at 30 frames, 24 and 30 frames per second. And they want to be able to up that to 40, to 60 rather. So that's one thing that's going to be in the new HDMI spec. I believe they are going to increase the color bit depth as well, possibly the color gamut as well. Let's see. Pecan Sandwich asks, are there any TVs with AirPlay built in? Good question. I don't know the answer to that. Anybody in the chat room? I'm trying to catch up with the chat room here. So if anybody knows that, let me know. Fred Flintstone just asked me about HDMI 2.0. I just told you about that. So there you go. What are my thoughts on Red Ray Del Shiro? This is a great question, too. This is another another way to get 4K content into the home. It's being done by a company called Red Digital Cinema. They are very well known for their digital cinema cameras, the Red Epic and the earlier Red One. In fact, The Hobbit was shot on the Red Epic at 5K. The actual imaging sensor is 5K. So it's even more than the 4K needed for 4K. But they also, at NAB last April, announced something called Red Ray. And what that is a hard disk-based server that you load 4K content onto the hard disk and then play it out to your 4K device. Now, the really cool thing about it is that they're taking pre-orders now, so presumably it's close to being ready to go, for $1,500. That's really something. $1,500 for a 4K server with undoubtedly terabytes of hard disk space. And so I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be great. They're using their own codec. They're not using H.265, which is the codec that everyone's been talking about for 4K. But they claim to be able to do 4K at, I believe it's 20 megabits per second, which is less than Blu-ray uses. Blu-ray is using a less efficient codec, typically H.264 or MPEG-4. But this new one that Blu-ray that Red-Ray is using, got to keep my colors straight here, gets 4K down to 20 megabits per second. Now, how good does that look? I'm a little suspicious because that's awfully, awfully low for that much information. Now, at NAB, they showed the Red-Ray player along with their 4K laser illuminated LCOS, we think, projector. They wouldn't tell us what the imaging technology was, but I think it's LCOS, same as JVC. Anyway, it didn't look very good. Now, I tend to suspect that it was probably the material. They were showing a movie that was shot specifically for that demo, and it was very low contrast, and it just didn't look very good. And I tend to believe it was probably the content rather than the reproduction chain. But in any event, I haven't heard anything about that 4K projector since then. That was going to be $10,000, which is really unheard of. The Sony 4K projector is $25,000. And that's really probably the only 4K projector I think that's available on the market today. Real 4K. You've got the JVC projectors, which do pseudo 4K with something called eShift, but they can't accept a native 4K signal. So all they can do is upconvert, quote unquote, by jiggling the pixels around. It kind of reminds me of wobulation from the old DLP days. But don't say that with JVC because they'll get mad. So let's see. Can Red Ray do 48 FPS 3D? Beatmaster asks, or actually Mooncat asks. I don't know the answer. I would suspect probably so. They're using HDMI, I'm pretty sure, to get from the Red Ray to the display. And I believe they have at least two HDMI outputs, maybe four. So that if the display can't do it from one HDMI, which it certainly wouldn't be able to do with 48 frame 3D, it could use multiple ones. let's see. Ooh, Midnight Rider. How did I like DTS Headphone X? I liked it a lot. It's really, really good. For those of you who don't know, this was at the DTS booth, and they have created an algorithm that simulates up to 11.1 channel audio in a standard set of headphones, any pair of headphones you want to connect to it. Somewhat like Dolby headphone, in that which also does this simulation. I thought it worked beautifully. They had a demo where they played a speaker identification signal in each channel. So you heard a voice say, left front speaker, center speaker, right front speaker, right surround side speaker, and so on around the room. And we had our headphones off, and we listened to it. Said, okay, that's all the speakers are being identified correctly. Then they said, okay, put the headphones on. So we put the headphones on, and they played the same thing. And I swear, I had to take my headphones off to see if those speakers weren't on. They weren't. But it sounded very much outside my head. It sounded like it was coming from the speakers I had just heard. So it works remarkably well, really, really well. I can't wait. I'm pretty sure they're working on licensing it to AV receiver manufacturers, maybe even TV manufacturers. You know, anybody that has a headphone output, they could license this technology too. And I think it works just great. I interviewed an engineer, a recording engineer, by the name of Jeff Emmerich, at the DTS booth at CES, which is included in one of the CES specials on twit.tv. So if you haven't seen that, you might look for it. This guy is amazing. He's been a recording engineer for 50 years. He engineered the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, Revolver, and Abbey Road, among, you know, working with virtually every other major act in the industry over the last 50 years. And he said that he was really looking forward to actually mixing an album using this technology. And I said, really? You've been in the best studios in the world. You've listened to the best equipment in the world, and you'd like to try mixing on this? He said, yeah, absolutely. It works that well. And I had to agree with him. It worked really, really well. So I can't wait to see it, or hear it rather, when it becomes available in certain products. Lawn Dog, do I think that HDMI will be upscalable for the future? Will it be able to handle future modifications? Absolutely. They're working on it right now. Web 6383, is HD video compressed on cable? Yes, very much so. Also on satellite. Less so, but still on terrestrial broadcast as well, which is why terrestrial broadcast actually typically looks the best of any delivery source. Because it is somewhat less compressed there than on cable and satellite, but it's compressed everywhere. Darkroom 08 says Control 4 a lot easier to program. We were talking about control systems before, and I don't have a lot of experience with these Crestron, AMX, and Control 4, but Darkroom 08 says the Control 4 is a lot easier to program, aside from being a lot cheaper. So that's probably the first direction I'd go. Let's see. Beatster 1174. Any opinions on the Polk Audio FX wireless surround unit? I don't know it. I can't say that I could make a reasonable comment on that. So wireless audio is a tricky thing. And I think at the end of this month, end of February anyway, I'm having on the one of the main technical guys from a organization called WESA, Wireless Sound Association, I think it is. And they're working on a standard for wireless audio that is gaining a lot of traction. And so look for that at the end of February. We'll be talking a lot about wireless audio at that point. And I'll try to remember to ask about this particular thing. Let's see. Salamander Sam. There you go. Can you describe the ins and outs and considerations of DLNA wireless streaming? DLNA stands for Digital Living Network Alliance. And it is the standard by which various devices can live on your home network and stream audio and video content from one to the other. They all have to be DLNA compliant. I personally always recommend avoiding wireless streaming if you can. Now, this is different from wireless audio, although it might not be if it's wireless digital audio. But the problem with wireless digital media streaming is that it's done typically at in the band of 2.4 gigahertz or 5.8 gigahertz, in which there's a lot of other traffic. A lot of other things operate in that region, and so you can get a lot lower reliability. So I always recommend for high-quality streaming from one DLNA device to another to have it hardwired. Now, sometimes that's not practical. You can't do it. So I tend to think that the 5.8 gigahertz band has less traffic than 2.4. So if you can operate in that band, that would probably be better. Try not to have any walls or many walls between the source device and the receiver device. It should be able to penetrate walls to some degree, but depending on what's in those walls, it might cause some problems. So that is another consideration to take into account. Beatmaster says, MPEG-2 did use a lot more bandwidth and space than AVC, correct? So it is very believable that RedRay can achieve 4K with 20 megabits. And they claim to have done that. So we shall see. So there we go. I've reached the bottom of the chat room, and I've also reached the end of my time. So I want to thank you all so much for being here and posing such great questions. It's always wonderful interacting with the chat room. Because I know that you guys will come up with tons of great stuff to talk about. In fact, I could go on and on and on, but I won't, because frame rate's coming up here in about 15 minutes. So I will just let you know that you can find my answers to listener questions at hometheaterhifi.com. And you can also find now my content that I'll be creating for avsforum.com. You can also email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. In fact, next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be David Bott, the founder of AVS Forum, who has some strong opinions about where the AV industry is now and where it's going. So that should be a very interesting conversation, and I do hope you will join me then. Until then, geek out.